I'm really delighted to be here to talk about my newest book, although I admit that, as always, it's a little daunting to prepare this talk and try to talk about an entire book in 45 minutes, a relatively brief time. So tonight what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to talk about how I came to write American Exodus. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the major points, and then I'm really going to tell a few of the stories of the people I follow in the book and how those people's stories reflect significant parts of the larger work. So one of the major inspirations for this book came from a 1936 essay contest, which was sponsored by a Chinese-American women's organization in New York City called the Ging Hok Club. I think there was recently a thing on them in MoCA. And the records are actually, I hope, still at MoCA, given the fire. This essay contest, and this is actually a picture of the second place essay with some of the winners. This essay dealt with a question of tremendous interest to many second-generation Chinese Americans in the 1930s. The question they were trying to answer in their essays was, does my future lie in China or America? The winning and second place essays and a lot of actual responses, somewhat very heated responses, to this question were published in an English language newspaper published in San Francisco by second-generation Chinese Americans themselves, barely older than the people who wrote the essays. And this is the Chinese Digest. Now, as someone who teaches Asian American history, I knew a lot about these essays because I've been teaching them for many years, since I first stumbled upon them in the mid-1990s while digging through old microfilm at the University of California, Berkeley's Ethnic Studies Library. A lot of us have copied them, and the microfilm is actually split. So many people have used this. Thankfully, they've since been digitized. I like teaching these because students of all backgrounds really relate to them. First, because most of the people who submitted essays to this contest were college students themselves. And second, because these kids who were answering these questions were grappling in some ways with a question that most college students have to address: what should I do with my life? Now, although these are almost universal questions for young adults, especially coming out of college, the students who I assigned to read these essays soon discover that the writers in 1936 faced some specific issues because of who they were. They were second-generation Chinese Americans, U.S. citizens by virtue of their birth on U.S. soil, who, for the most part, were the children of immigrant merchants. These merchant parents were forbidden because of their race from becoming U.S. citizens. Many of their children, the essay writers among them, possessed what we often call a sort of transnational identity that reflected pride in and attachment to their Chinese heritage and their American birth. That meaning had a particularly fraught weight at a time when China was a struggling republic, increasingly facing Japanese encroachment and aggression. But above all, these essay writers were young people who, because of their race and ancestry, had almost no chance of experiencing the same treatment as their white peers, even in the best of times in pre-war America, meaning no chance to live in the same kinds of neighborhoods, work in jobs equal to their educations, or enjoy almost any social or economic mobility because of the racism they encountered everywhere. And of course, these young people had the grave misfortune of coming of age in the midst of the Great Depression, which simply compounded the effects of the racism they already faced. So I really enjoy teaching these essays. I've done so for many years, and about 6 years ago, I assigned them yet again to my Asian American history course. This is one thing that I continue to assign every time I teach this class. After our class met, we had this great discussion, and then a student stayed after, and she asked a question I really couldn't answer. She said, "What happened to the second generation Chinese Americans that we looked at? Did they end up going to China, or did they stay in America?" Now, actually, I knew what had happened to the essay writers themselves. The guy who advocated a future in China had stayed in America, and the guy who had advocated a future in America had gone to China. However, she wasn't asking that question about the two people. She was asking about the generation. Had they stayed in China, or had they gone to China, or had they stayed in America? And when I was trying to answer her question, I couldn't find an answer for it anywhere. What had happened to these people? I thought, well, hey, this might be worth an article. And so that article became American Exodus, which obviously is a book because it turned out to be a very, very rich subject. So what I discovered quite soon after diving into my research for the article that became a book is that 1936 was the end point. It was the tail end of a long, numerically significant emigration of Chinese American citizens to China. That emigration began as a trickle in the 1890s, partly because there just weren't that many Chinese American citizens at this time, and it really picked up after 1901. And of course, there weren't many Chinese American citizens before the turn of the century and for many years afterwards because of the Chinese Exclusion Act. I'm going to talk a tiny bit about that because I really think it's important to understanding the larger book. It's crucial to the context. So as the slide says, between 1882 and 1943, the United States banned all Chinese immigrants except merchants, students, and tourists from entering the country and forbade the naturalization of the few Chinese who were allowed in. Now, the reason there was a second generation group of Chinese Americans was because under the 14th Amendment, Chinese born on U.S. soil or ethnic Chinese born on U.S. soil to Chinese alien parents were still U.S. citizens. And the Supreme Court confirmed that in the Wong Kim Ark case of 1898, which is a landmark decision. Under the Exclusion Act, however, China-born merchants could emigrate and bring their immediate family members to America, including wives and family members. What that meant is that these couples were responsible for the majority of Chinese American citizen children. Most of the Chinese Americans born and second-generation people born on U.S. soil had merchant parents. The larger immigration context of this is also important. The context of the early 20th century exclusion era is important to understanding the book because in the early 20th century, China-born merchants and Chinese American citizens, or at least those purporting to be Chinese American citizens or merchants, these people often claimed to have fathered sons during visits to wives in China. There was a big gender imbalance in Chinese American communities. Many men only had a chance to marry if they married in China, but they could not generally bring, it's a lot of background in immigration law, but they, many people chose not to bring wives in, and American citizen men could not, under the law, bring wives in. So they claimed when they went to China that they generally had fathered a son while they were staying and visiting their wives in China. And, of course, this created a paper record, what we often call a slot, that could later be sold to somebody who wanted to come into the United States purporting to be a family member of a legally domiciled merchant or a derivative U.S. citizen through his father. Many of you are familiar with this. This is the paper son route to emigration. There were thousands of so-called paper sons and a few paper daughters who came to the United States during the early 20th century. And I don't really want to go into that so much, but the context here is that this was a period, the early 20th century, in which thousands of China-born people were attempting to enter the United States despite the exclusion law. And why I bring that up is because from the outside, if you look at the Chinese Americans born on U.S. soil, they, after the turn of the century, almost uniformly possessed extensive documentation of their birth, often birth certificates. And they appear from the outside, thus, to have been the most privileged people in their communities. They didn't have to pretend to be someone's son to stay in America. They didn't have to memorize questions about their village and relatives and supposed siblings and other tiny details in preparation for withstanding an immigration agent's interrogation at Angel Island. They were already in America. They were legitimate and documented. And this is where I started to realize one of the pieces of significance about my book was that this was also a moment. So thousands of Chinese are trying to travel across the Pacific to come to the United States, lawfully and unlawfully. This is a moment in U.S. history, of course, where another immigration is shaping the United States, which is mass immigration from Europe. Millions of Europeans, mostly from Southern and Eastern Europe, poured into especially the East Coast ports of the United States. And this, I think, is a time we think of as central to America's identity, what we think of as this identity of America as an irresistible magnet for immigrants and a land of unparalleled opportunity and upward mobility, if not for them, then for their children, right? This is an old story that we often talk about, why America is special, because the immigrants struggled and their children were able to have better lives. And at the same moment, though, Native-born Chinese-American citizens did not enjoy that upward mobility. In fact, they faced downward mobility in American society. And so for this reason, I realized America, at the very moment we think of as it's an immigrant magnet, was also an immigrant-sending nation. Very few people noticed then, and I think few people notice or realize now, because it contradicts our national narrative. But Chinese-American citizens were part of that immigration. By the 1910s, about 5,000 Chinese-American citizens had moved to China at a time when there were only 14,000 native-born Chinese-American citizens. 5,000 had moved to China. That's more than a third. Thousands more left for China in the 1920s and 1930s. Again, given the small native-born population at that time, which peaked about 40,000 in 1940, that means that between one-third and one-half of all truly native-born Chinese-Americans likely emigrated to China between 1901 and the late 1930s. And that's because I think that as the children largely of immigrant merchant strivers, they, like their parents, sought upward economic, social, and educational mobility, and they saw increasingly that that was more likely in Hong Kong and China than it was in the United States. So this is really where I began to dig into my research. And I realized that among the thousands of Chinese Americans who emigrated to China, there were really two distinct groups. And it gives you a sense of the China they were emigrating to. The emigration really begins in earnest in 1901 at the time when sort of the twilight of the Qing dynasty. The biggest group, there were two distinct groups of Chinese Americans who emigrated to China. The first and largest group were those I call the students and merchants. They came from all over America, big cities, small towns, rural areas, places I often had never heard of. I had a sort of Google map a lot here for the United States part of this. By and large, they moved to Hong Kong and Guangdong. And if you know anything about exclusion era Chinese immigration, whether lawful or unlawful, and pre-exclusion era, about 95% of Chinese Americans at that time, they traced their ancestry to South China, the Guangdong, particularly the Pearl River Delta. So that's where the students and merchants emigrated to. They did this for educational and business opportunities. Some started their own businesses, often manufacturing kind of facsimiles of American-made products. Others attended village schools to get a so-called Chinese education. A lot, I realized as time went on, attended special overseas Chinese academies where they were supposed to get a so-called Chinese education, but one that was often delivered to them in English. And still others, older immigrants, came to South China and enrolled in Western-founded colleges, such as Canton Christian College, often mingling with other so-called overseas Chinese students and the scions of wealthy local families who realized that it was to their great advantage of their children to get an education in English. So this is the first cohort I noticed, the merchant and student immigrants. The second cohort, whom I call in my book the modernizers, had largely grown up in urban America, especially New York, San Francisco, and Honolulu, and had studied at U.S. universities. And they were in that way very similar to the 1936 essay writers. They tended to think of themselves as destined to contribute to what they considered the modernization of China through using their Western educations to develop its infrastructure, schools, legal system, military, and similar fields. And here's one example. This Dr. Pond M.G., he and actually his entire family, his brothers and one of his sisters, moved to China. Their father was a Christian minister in San Francisco, and they moved to China to modernize it in the way they understood modernization, through especially using their professional educations to change its educational system. One of the brothers was an engineer. He was a doctor. So these are sort of very, very technical idea of modernization. And I will say not everybody who was a modernizer had gone to university. Some had gone to specialized vocational schools. Some of the most famous modernizers were aviators, pilots like Tom Gunn and Art Lim. Both of them San Franciscans who attended Glenn Curtis School of Aviation at a time when very few Americans ever got a pilot's license either. So these modernizers believed that they were going to be part of China's modernization, and they began coming in large numbers after 1901, in the very last years of the Qing dynasty, often taking jobs offered to them by the Qing government as the dynasty attempted to reform very quickly, develop infrastructure, a new legal system, a better military, and a modern economy. Now, the students and the merchants and the modernizers obviously arrived in China at a very interesting moment, a moment of tremendous change. In 1911, a revolution challenged and eventually toppled the last imperial government. In 1912, a republic replaced the dynasty. Warlords eventually governed much of China by 1916, and then the Nationalist Party reunified significant areas of the country between 1926 and 28 and in the years after. And of course, by the early 1930s, Japan was encroaching upon and finally invaded China. And so this is a very difficult time. It's a time in which the meaning of Chineseness is being contested and the meaning of modernity and modernization is being contested. And during these years, Chinese American citizens in China increasingly found themselves moving in social and economic circles that mixed them with China-born people who had attended college in the United States, people often referred to as returned students. They also mixed with the children of earlier citizen immigrants, local graduates of westernized universities, and well-to-do overseas Chinese from Southeast Asia, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. In other words, they were often moving in quite cosmopolitan and westernized social circles, often in the coastal cities. They were expressing identities that were transnational and hybrid rather than exclusive and narrowly nationalist with the small n. Yet over time, expressing such identities, being cosmopolitan, became increasingly problematic in the eyes of many China-born activists and patriots. In other words, rising and increasingly anti-foreign nationalism in China began by the 1920s to create real problems for the Chinese-American emigres and also caused many of them to develop very complicated feelings about their place in China and the regimes that claimed control over them. And here's where things get even more complicated. Because to add to the complexity of the situation, successive Chinese governments from the late Qing to the nationalists claimed that all ethnic Chinese were ever born were Chinese subjects or citizens, regardless of how these people defined themselves. Of course, under U.S. law, Chinese Americans born on U.S. soil were also U.S. citizens, which made them dual citizens. And that meant, of course, that Chinese Americans supposedly enjoyed the benefits of something that operated in China until really 1943. And this was a system called extraterritoriality. It was a system that the foreign powers had imposed on China beginning in the mid-19th century. And what it meant was that if a foreigner committed a crime in China, for example, Chinese officials had to hand that foreign citizen over to a representative of his or her nation for trial. If convicted, that convicted foreigner would serve in a foreign prison, often outside of China. Extraterritoriality also meant that foreigners who enjoyed that status were not liable for certain taxes, and they could also, and were encouraged, in fact, to register their businesses with their consulates for added protection. Furthermore, to further complicate this, significant chunks of numerous Chinese cities during these years, including Guangzhou, Tianjin, and most notably Shanghai, were under foreign control because of the same treaties that had essentially undermined China's sovereignty beginning in the mid-19th century. And it's a very confusing system, but this is an 1899 map of China that shows the degree of foreign spheres, control, and domination in various places. So, of course, Hong Kong was a colony. The new territories, which became part of Hong Kong, were a leased territory for 99 years. there were various treaty ports that had been opened to foreign trade by treaty, and foreigners could live there. And there were many different iterations of this. And, of course, the most famous of this kind of system was in Shanghai. Shanghai was actually largely controlled by in the French government and an elected council made basically voted on by foreigners. So there was something called the French Concession, which is this, and then the International Settlement is this. And those were basically outside of China's sovereignty. And policed, actually, by foreign police, many of them colonial subjects of Britain and France as well, and not considered to be, in fact, within China. So, as I mentioned, Chinese Americans were dual citizens, whether they wanted to be or not, but they could use the status at times to their advantage. They could be Chinese when this was advantageous, such as if they inherited property outside of areas where foreigners were allowed to own property, or if they wished to have a job in one of the Chinese governments in the Republican period, a job that was not allowed to a foreigner. At the same time, they could be U.S. citizens when they needed protection from rapacious officials or from certain laws. But such advantages only existed if the U.S. government upheld their citizenship rights, and that began to change over time. So as I said at the outset of the talk, capturing an entire book in a relatively brief talk is difficult, but the life stories of some of the people I wrote about in American Exodus highlight several of the themes I've just mentioned and the kind of issues, from the question of citizenship, questions of loyalty and identity, to the changing relationship between Chinese-American citizens, different Chinese regimes, and the U.S. government. So what I'm going to turn to do now is, for the rest of my talk, I'm going to talk a little bit about the lives of three Chinese Americans who emigrated over time, over the period I've written about, and what happened to them over time, and how this reflects some of the larger themes of the book. So the first person I want to talk about is a man named Louis Shuck. He's one of the first generation of immigrants that I wrote about in the book. So Louis Shuck was a native of the small California gold rush town of Weaverville. He was born to merchant parents in 1872, 10 years before exclusion. He went to China briefly as a teenager for education, returned, lived in San Francisco, where he married, and became actually a prosperous, well-known merchant. But racism and discrimination always limited his family's social, economic, and educational mobility. And having traveled to China and Hong Kong a few times for business, he actually believed that those places offered his family more of a future. So in 1907, he moved to the British colony of Hong Kong with his Chinese-American citizen wife and their five U.S. citizen children. After the end of the Qing dynasty, around 1912, the Louis resettled in Guangzhou on the Chinese mainland with the assumption that it would be a better business climate in the new republic. These moves, especially the move to Hong Kong, in fact, accomplished what Louis Shuck had hoped. Louis became a wealthy merchant in South China, very well known. He was what was known as a comprador, which was essentially the senior Chinese employee, but he was actually more of a go-between through whom all transactions with Chinese officials or Chinese employees were processed through. Compradors were politically influential, and they often grew quite wealthy, and certainly Louis grew quite wealthy. He became a fixture in elite social circles in Chinese Hong Kong. In San Francisco, where his children had been born, the segregated Oriental public school offered the kids a fifth-grade education at most. In Hong Kong and then Guangzhou, however, Louis was able to enroll his sons and daughters in the most prestigious private academies. He sent several back to America for college, and he ensured that the oldest in particular married very, very well upon their return to China, where these American-born kids, too, also envisioned a future. So Louis's oldest surviving son, one of his sons had died, but his oldest surviving son was James Zhengyan Louis. James Louis actually married the niece of the American-educated diplomat and politician, W.W. Yen, and Louis's daughter, who's up there on the top left, Louis's daughter, Frances Yakyang Louis, and yes, they all did spell their names differently in English documents, which is one of my frustrations in doing the project. But his daughter Frances married David W.K. Au, a son of Sincere Department Store founder Andrew Au Bun. And if you know anything about the Sincere Department Store, it was one of the overseas Chinese founded big four department stores. And it also actually got into things like insurance, banking. It was a major corporation. And so the Au family was very, very wealthy and influential. So the oldest children in particular wed very well. But the nationalist movement that Louis Shuck had actually supported in 1912 and 1913 eventually targeted people like Louis as lackeys of Western imperialism. In 1926, the nationalists in Guangzhou arrested and held Louis's second wife. The first had actually died a few years earlier. He remarried and had a young son. And he worked in Hong Kong but kept his family in Guangzhou. Nationalists held his wife and son basically hostage until he paid a hefty war tax on his property. And here's his letter pleading with the U.S. government to intervene. U.S. officials had a few years earlier in a similar situation assured Louis Shuck that American citizens like him did not need to comply with such taxes. And they now, however, washed their hands of him because of his ethnicity. Racial nationalism was on the rise in Washington, D.C. In 1927, just a year later, nationalist supporters in Shanghai kidnapped Louis Shuck's grandson, Lincoln Au. It's actually a fairly famous case, and forced the Au family to make a $500,000 contribution to the nationalists to gain the boy's freedom. And this is Lincoln. He was very young. He was snatched by a soldier from his mother's arms when she was walking in Shanghai. For reasons like these, by the late 1930s, most of the Louis family responded by settling in foreign-controlled areas of Shanghai or in Hong Kong to avoid the reach of the nationalist government. In other words, they settled in places where they could be Chinese sort of places that were beyond the government of China and its ability to touch them. Now, a man who was born almost 30 years after Louis Shuck is the next person I want to talk about. This is a man named Russell Bates Shu Chun. He was a third-generation American who served briefly in the U.S. Army at the end of World War I, had attended Boston University, Columbia, and NYU's law school. He was a classic modernizer. He moved to China in 1922, shortly after graduating from law school. This is a period of economic boom in America after a long recession. This is a period in which a similarly educated white law school graduate in the United States would likely have been deluged with job offers. As a Chinese American, however, Russell Chun was not. So instead, he built a lucrative legal practice in Shanghai, which by the mid-1920s boasted more Chinese-American citizen lawyers than New York, San Francisco, and Honolulu combined, because they simply had no options in America. Russell Chun also became socially active in expatriate social clubs in Shanghai. One of my favorite moments was when he introduced Moxie Soda, which is a favorite New England beverage, to China in 1936. In the late 1920s, he married into a prominent family closely connected to one of the warlord factions that the new nationalist regime had recently sidelined. By that point, he became good friends with Lawrence Clint Kentwell. He's on the bottom left here. L.K. Kentwell he's also rather notorious in Shanghai at this point. He's a Hong Kong-born Eurasian lawyer who had felt the sting of racism throughout his life. He was not able to join any of the European clubs. He was looked down on by fellow British citizens. Chun and Kentwell's friendship became obvious to outsiders for the first time when the two men tried but failed to convince the foreign resident elected Shanghai Municipal Council, which governed the Shanghai International Settlement, to allow Chinese representation on the council. And they did this because there were tens of thousands of Chinese in the International Settlement. They far outnumbered foreigners and had no representation. Their measure failed 300 votes to 3. So they voted. Both Chun and Kentwell were actually, as foreign citizens, they were ratepayers in the settlement, and they were able to vote. Only one other person, a Chinese-American lawyer, voted for them. Now, Kentwell eventually, in 1938, collaborated with the Japanese after they invaded China, publishing Voice of a New China, a newspaper under Japanese sponsorship. Chen followed his friend into collaboration, serving under, using his Chinese name, in two puppet governments during the occupation. Not only the reformed government of the Republic of China, but also Wang Jingwei's reorganized government of the Republic of China. Now, Kentwell had a pretty difficult end. He was tried for treason by the nationalist government and imprisoned. Essentially, he was inherited by the communists when they took over the mainland in 1949 and died in prison in the early 1950s. Russell Chen slipped over the border into Hong Kong at some point right after the war and basically resumed using his American name and identity. Built a second business career working for Raleigh Brothers in Hong Kong and died in bed in 1982. I don't think anybody ever figured out that they were the same person. Now, you might notice I haven't really talked so much about women yet. And that's because in the early years of the Chinese-American immigration, relatively few Chinese-American women relocated to China on their own. Many, like Frances Louis, went with family members. But most parents were unwilling to allow their female children to emigrate to China for work or education unless they were going to a village school in South China under family supervision. But during the Great Depression, female university graduates and high school dropouts alike emigrated to China for work with the blessing of their mothers and fathers. The economy was just simply too terrible. And many of these people, these women, ended up supporting families in the United States with their earnings in China. Two of the emigres I've found and wrote about were the Hawaiian-born sisters, Edna and Evelyn Gu. They arrived in Shanghai in 1933. They opened pretty quickly after that the American Beauty Shop on Bubbling Wall Road inside the International Settlement. This was, of course, again, the foreign-governed and police section of the city. Now, until the outbreak of the Second Sino-Japanese War in 1937, the Gu sisters' salon remained very, very popular and quite profitable. Profitable enough, in fact, to support the two women, their mother and their youngest sister. But it also showed how Chinese Americans and other so-called overseas Chinese were increasingly occupying an uncomfortable place in nationalist China. During the 1930s, Chiang Kai-shek launched something called the New Life Movement, which was really a fascist-inflected campaign meant to teach Chinese citizens obedience, self-restraint, discipline, hygiene, and respect for authority. A deeply anti-foreign current crackled through the New Life Movement, whose most ardent practitioners organized boycotts of foreign goods and even physically attacked Chinese who wore Western clothes or watched foreign movies or danced in nightclubs. In 1934, New Life Movement leaders declared that permanent waves were, quote, ugly and dangerous, unquote, and the next year barred them for all women. The Gu sisters specialized in permanent waves, and though they belonged to the patriotic, pro-nationalist Chinese Women's Club of Shanghai, they and many other Chinese Americans skirted New Life Movement restrictions by living and working inside the International Settlement. Again, a space that was Chinese, but not in within the reach of the nationalist government, a space where they could more define Chinese-ness for themselves. Now, the Gu sisters both left Shanghai when war broke out in 1937 and returned to Hawaii. Evelyn married a plantation physician there, but for a number of years, Edna had to support herself, and she did so initially before the war by taking a job as a maid for a white family. That was the best job she could get, a woman who had owned her own business, a quite thriving one in Shanghai. Other Chinese Americans who fled Shanghai and other parts of China to return to the United States in 1937 faced similarly disappointing choices. Now, Louis Shuck, Russell Chen, and the Gu sisters led very different lives, obviously, but together they capture some of the main themes of American exodus. The racism that Chinese Americans faced both in the United States and from U.S. consular officials in China, the shrinking opportunities for Chinese Americans inside China by the late 1920s, Chinese Americans' uneasy relationship with the different regimes that govern the mainland, and their eventual retreat often into areas on China's fringes, from warlord-controlled Guangdong to British Hong Kong to Shanghai's concession areas. In these cosmopolitan zones, their English fluency and U.S. passports gave Chinese Americans an unusual degree of mobility, privilege, and opportunity, and enabled them to build lives in China, but beyond the reach of the nationalist regime. The nature of their identities became clear in 1937 when the Japanese invaded China and occupied all of Shanghai except for the French concession and the international settlement. And eventually the Japanese occupied much of Guangdong, but not Hong Kong until 1941. At that time, in that sort of interim period, the Chinese nationalists urged patriotic Chinese to follow the regime inland, bring their skills, their money, their factories. By 1940, the American government was calling on its citizens in China to leave because of the widening and worsening U.S.-Japan relationship and Gulf. While hundreds of Chinese Americans did leave for the U.S. if they could, hundreds more hunkered down in the concession areas in occupied Guangdong and in Hong Kong, and essentially made a losing bet on the persistence of peace. And they were willing to make this bet, to take a tremendous risk, because they had built far more fulfilling lives in the quasi-colonial, denationalized spaces on China's fringes than they could ever imagine having in either of the two nations that claimed them, the United States or nationalist China. Now, most of the Chinese Americans who found themselves trapped in Japanese-occupied China after 1941, and I should explain that on what was December 8, 1941 in Asia, the Japanese took over the international settlement, tightened their grip on the French concession, began to attack Hong Kong and other in-between spaces, as I call them. Most of the Chinese Americans who found themselves trapped in Japanese-occupied China after Pearl Harbor spent the next 3 years nominally free. They were not, by and large, put in concentration camps the way many white Americans were. And this is not the case with everybody, but the majority. They were not put in concentration camps because of Japan's loudly proclaimed goal of Asia for the Asians. But that didn't mean that life was easy. Most lived on the brink of starvation. Among others, somebody Anthony mentioned, William Yukon Chang, later publisher of the pioneering New York paper Chinese American Times, survived in occupied Shanghai by trading anything and everything he could find on the black market, from bike tires to quinine. The architect Poi Gum Lee supported his whole family by teaching at the puppet-controlled St. John's University. James and Marion Yi, who were doctors at Peking Union Medical College, received loans from the Swiss consulate, which represented American interests in occupied China and made small loans to the most destitute people. And the Yis lost their jobs because they refused to work in PUMC under Japanese control. As I mentioned before, of course, some Chinese Americans did collaborate with the Japanese, including Russell Chen. But a handful also actively resisted. Sort of one of the least known, but person I think should be far more well known for this, was Ruth Moy. Ruth Moy shielded underground U.S. agents at her home in Shanghai in the French concession. And her son, Loring, who was a teenager, secretly took photos of Japanese activities and installments in the city and passed them to the American agents who were using the family's home. She actually won a Medal of Freedom for her valor during the war. It was presented to her in 1951. Now, many Chinese Americans who were trapped in occupied China eventually did flee to unoccupied China during the war. But for scores of such refugees, the reality of life in what became known in the United States as Free China undermined whatever remaining faith they still had in the stability, competence, and integrity of the Kuomintang regime. It now appeared that many of the leaders whom they once believed would bravely leave China against Japan were more adept at lining their own pockets than at running an efficient government. In the end, the way that the already persistent problems of corruption and cronyism worsened during the war, despite the pressing need for national unity and common purpose, made a profound impression on almost all of the Chinese American citizens who passed into Free China and talked about what they saw. They also gained a new impression of the United States. Japan's wartime propaganda routinely used racist American immigration laws to remind the Chinese and other people of color in Asia that the United States refused to admit Asian immigrants or grant them citizenship. In response, the U.S. Congress in 1943 reluctantly passed the Chinese Exclusion Repeal Act, which also not only repealed exclusion, it gave China a 105-person-a-year quota for immigration, but it finally allowed Chinese to naturalize as U.S. citizens. In addition, America's need for wartime workers pushed employers, the military, and the U.S. government to recruit significant numbers of women and people of color for the first time. Chinese American, both alien and citizen, now streamed into the U.S. military, the defense industry, and the mainstream economy, and they also participated in wartime coalitions for civil rights. Entrenched systematic racial discrimination continued to limit Chinese American opportunities long after the war, but never again were Chinese American horizons quite as narrow as they had been in pre-war decades. In Free China, many Chinese American emigre refugees noted the racist attitudes of the white American officers and civilians who were working with the Chinese government to fight the Japanese. But these Chinese Americans were also deeply impressed by the sight of Chinese Americans direct from the United States serving as officers in the American military and specialists in American agencies. Many of the Chinese American citizen refugees sensed, as a result, that America was slowly becoming a more hospitable place for them than the nation they had left behind many years earlier. Forced to contemplate where their futures would now be, the vast majority of the emigres in Free China gambled on this vision of incremental progress. Essentially, they chose America. In fact, after the war, almost every Chinese American citizen who had stayed in China during the conflict returned to the United States, while very few who fled the country between 1937 and 1941 ever returned to China to rebuild. By 1946, even before the civil war between the communists and nationalists really consumed the country, Chinese American citizens were pouring out of China. In the first months of 1946, the reopened U.S. consulate in Guangzhou offered repatriation assistance to such people. And by autumn of that year, about 1,500 Chinese American citizens had left, including scores of young adults whose parents sent them to China during the Depression. And these are just some of the records I found. There are hundreds of records of young adults who were sent to China during the Depression to get a Chinese education, and in large part because it was cheaper to raise them there with relatives, and who flooded out of China after the war. Even the handful of modernizers who initially chose to stay in China after 1945 eventually left China for good after the Chinese Civil War began again in earnest. As the children of merchants, many were fearful of communism, for sure, but moreover, they realized that the pre-war world in which they had once moved and thrived was gone. Before 1941, the existence of colonies, foreign concessions, quasi-independent warlord territories, and overlapping and often conflicting citizenship statuses had created economic, social, and educational opportunities for Chinese Americans while protecting their often ambiguous identities. What we call the Pacific War, the period between December 8, 1941 and August 1945, destroyed that world. Out of consideration for allied China, Great Britain and the United States in 1943 finally repudiated extraterritoriality and agreed finally as well to accept Chinese control of the old concession areas. Elsewhere in Asia, the Japanese fanned the flames of existing anti-colonialism, undercutting the position of ethnic Chinese who often served as intermediaries between European colonizers and their subject peoples. Such moves helped topple the pillars of the pre-war world of Chinese Americans in China, with its vague boundaries, overlapping jurisdictions, and complicated citizenship and nationality statuses. The Chinese Civil War and its aftermath then eliminated what was left of that world's economic foundations. Even before the People's Republic of China entered the Korean War against the United States in late 1950, it was obvious that there would be no new Back to China movement. Thank you. Yeah, that's always, I love sources. I'm a complete primary source nerd. So this was an interesting book to research. I had expected to be able to find more and gain greater access to sources in mainland China. That's a persistent problem for foreign researchers. I was able to do my first research at the Shanghai Municipal Archives, but the major archive for this period in China was actually closed for digitization at the Second National Archives in Nanjing. When I was in China and able to get a letter from an organization to sponsor me to do research. But in the end, I don't think it ended up mattering because like the people I was looking at themselves, the records for Chinese Americans in China were often in between places. So I ended up doing a lot of research at the Institute of Modern History in Taiwan, the Kuomintang archives, both at the Hoover Institution in Stanford, where they've digitized or microfilmed some of them, and also in Taiwan. But I also found that there's a huge amount of well, newspapers that circulated in this world, both in Chinese and English, as well as a lot of especially the nationalist government had published a lot of overseas Chinese internal documents and journals. But one of the things that really surprised me was the best source of documents was in the United States, which really stunned me. I hadn't expected that. I went to use just a glance at the State Department records and the records of the consuls in South China and then Shanghai, and I found hundreds of pages of records that... So this is a historian's dream. I started asking for these records at the National Archives desk. They push out these big trolleys that have their about, you know, 10 records, whatever, volumes, boxes. So these were consular volumes. They were bound volumes, all wrapped in plastic, shrink-wrapped in plastic. So I'm opening all of these. They're covered with dust. I'm allergic to dust. I didn't care. I was like, wow, what is this? So finally, after the 7th or 8th bound volume group came out, I asked the archivist, do you guys rewrap these every time? And he said, oh, no. If they're wrapped in plastic, that means they were wrapped this way when they were transferred from the old National Archives building in central D.C. to College Park in 1992 or 3. He said, so they haven't been used since then. But then he said, but you know, I don't think these have ever been used. Oh, as a historian, those are the words you love to hear. And what I found was these were records of Chinese Americans who got in trouble often in China, in South China, and asked for the intervention of the consuls. I was able to match them often with a whole host of documents in regional offices, including in New York, of what were called the records of pre-application of alleged American-born citizen or American citizen of the Chinese race for pre-investigation of status. If a Chinese American wanted to move to China, they would get their status investigated to make it easier to come back if they wanted to. A lot of people don't know those exist, so I've actually reached out to people when I found extensive records, and I found someone who had done this post on her grandfather, who was a Taiwanese independence activist back in the 30s, and she said, "Oh, you know, there's this big blank area. I wish I knew more." And I was like, "I have your grandmother's immigration records." And she said, "No, that's impossible. She's not an immigrant." I'm like, "Well," and I sent them, and she said, "It was the document dump of the century." She had no idea. People don't use them, but they're extraordinary. And the nice thing about them is that they often have. So they have testimony of people in support, both really white Americans and other Chinese Americans, information about villages, but they also have names in Chinese. So if you read Chinese, which I do, then you can use that and follow these people to China and find other records. So I have thousands and thousands of pages, and I just wrote a little research note about it for Chinese America History and Perspectives, which is the journal of the Chinese Historical Society of America, just because I really want other people to use these records. They're incredibly rich, and if there's a lot of translated material, translated by staff of the U.S. consulates in China. So if you're trying to do genealogical or other kinds of research and you don't read Chinese, which is a major problem for a lot of people, they're translated. It's really extraordinary, so I encourage people to use those.
I found in the recent years China, when the economic opportunities attracted a lot of Americans to go there, the Westerners and the Chinese Americans are basically treated differently. Although they were all treated well, but Chinese Americans, even like in a foreign language school teaching English, although they're both native language, Chinese Americans are paid lower. So I'm wondering, during that period, was that also the case?
That's a great question. It reminds me of when I first went to China and I taught English at a school with a Chinese American woman who was in our same program, and we spoke Chinese at the same level, we used chopsticks the same, we got paid the same, but she got criticized a lot more for everything that was wrong about her, and everything I did was wonderful. So one of the things I found was that, it's difficult sometimes to find some of the statistics about pay, but I do know that by the 1930s, a lot of the foreign companies were laying off white Americans and other people seen as white in Shanghai in particular, and hiring Chinese Americans in their place. It's kind of hard to come up with more than anecdotal evidence for that, but that certainly seems to have been happening. What a lot of Chinese Americans struggled with, especially more over time, was that many of them didn't speak Chinese very well, or they didn't speak the dialect of Shanghai. So they often moved in the sort of settlement world. Russell Chen was a lawyer in the American court for China for a long time, for example, and he actually spoke Chinese. And so I found that that was the case in terms of different treatment, but I also found that it's hard to do direct comparisons because a lot of Chinese Americans were hired for jobs that white foreigners were not hired for. And I know that some of them did complain about the money they made, which is, again, why you have people like the Goo sisters choosing, specifically seeking out not a Chinese clientele, but sort of an overseas, a Chinese diaspora, and a white clientele, and trying to carve their own place, because increasingly the place for them is really restricted.
What was the possibly the motivation for the American companies firing white Americans?
They were more expensive. I mean, that was the definite. And there was the assumption that they would require more of a living stipend than Chinese Americans. And certainly I know that in Chongqing during the war and in Kunming, that Chinese American emigre refugees were paid and hired at the local rate. And sort of one of the most famous, Flora Bell Jan, sort of the Chinese flapper, of the 1920s, and a lot of sociological studies. She is an author, writer. She ended up working for U.S. agencies in China and complaining that she was being paid so much less than the white employees. There was no food, housing allowance at a time when inflation in Chongqing and other, you know, areas of free China was roaring, so she would lose the worth of her salary, even though, in fact, what they valued was her sort of American identity and abilities in English, right? So that was Chinese Americans who were hired and brought straight from the mainland were paid the same as their white counterparts, but you know, not before the war. That was certainly that there was the preference for hiring someone you could pay them less and less overhead and stipend. So yeah.
Do you see any parallels in like the recent generations? Because like I've seen like more recent generations of Chinese American university graduates who are opting to go to China to start their careers because of opportunities there in the, I guess, new China. So have you drawn any parallels between the period that you studied and like the recent decade?
Yeah, a few. I mean, more just again from anecdotal evidence, I know that there's actually a thriving sort of Chinese American community in Hong Kong, and certainly I know of friends and from college who also moved to China for greater opportunity. The thing is, I think it's kind of interesting because I think also a lot of non-Chinese American U.S. citizens have done the same, but I think that the problem that Chinese American citizens encounter often that I've looked at more in terms of recent years is the tendency of Chinese officials in the PRC to overlook their identity as U.S. citizens and try to ignore it in case they, you know, get into trouble in some way with the law or perceived as such, that they are U.S. citizens, especially if they're born in the U.S., but whether, you know, if they've naturalized. PRC law says that. Actual officials on the ground haven't recognized that. I do know that the PRC is trying to encourage Chinese Americans and other so-called overseas Chinese to come and give their skills, I think, because of both the brain drain of the last few years, but also because of the birth rate is shrinking. So they've created new kinds of long-term visas for people of Chinese ancestry. So it's kind of interesting moment to see how that's going to shake out. Especially, you know, I gave a talk at Cornell a few months ago, and I talked mostly about this period, the period of the Republican era, but I did sort of end with, there was a case reported in the New York Times a year or two ago, in which a Chinese American citizen born in the U.S. was being held, not arrested, held and not allowed to leave, and that the State Department has in the last year or two issued warnings specifically to people of Chinese ancestry in China that they are more likely to be singled out, and to be careful, and not to enter trying to use a Chinese passport, for example. But that's not been the case in any of these. So, yeah.
I loved the three stories that are evocative of such larger trends. And this is probably outside of your research scope, but I'm wondering if the descendants of those three individuals and the sisters have stories that you could tell us about their lives today.
So I was able, in the epilogue to the book, I actually do try at least to follow some of these people beyond the war. Louis Shuck died in 1948. He had returned to the United States in 1940. His one of his sons had also returned to the United States, but their families were trapped in Hong Kong. Louis died. As I say, it's interesting if you look at his photos over time, what he faced really aged him. Russell Chun, I think, was sort of the most interesting of all. I noticed a name when I pulled his Form 430 file. His daughter, Gladys, had made an inquiry to the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong in the late 50s. She immigrated to the United States with her Hong Kong-born husband in the mid 70s, a few years before his death. So this is kind of an ongoing story. And the Goo sisters, I was not able to, I mean, both of them essentially married eventually in Hawaii, settled down, passed away in the 1990s. One of the things I found was interesting, I was able in some cases to follow these stories, and the book I'm working on right now is actually looking at a family that, actually, Ruth Moy's family or her husband's family, a New York family where some of them stayed in New York, some emigrated to China, some ended up on the Japanese side, some, like her, ended up, you know, spying for the United States. Her husband, they divorced quickly after the war, ended up serving with the Nationalists. So, you know, the choices people make, which I think are interesting. I have been able to actually get in touch with the family members, but they're very scattered and have no idea. But one of the things I figured out when I was writing this is that I think every Chinese-American family with roots in the pre-1949 period, you know, that was established in the United States before then, has some member of their family who made this trip, who emigrated, or almost everyone. And it was pretty typical where half people would go and half of them would stay, depending on what they thought would be the best future. And it's really extraordinary. I don't think that people know much about it or talk about it because, of course, by the 1950s, China was the enemy, and people who had lived in China were potentially suspect, and the United States was actively attempting to stop people from visiting family members in China. It was possible to do that if you went to Hong Kong. You could slip over the border, but the United States government instituted a sort of reign of terror in Chinese-American communities, and this was supposed to mean that these people, if they were slipping over the border, were going to be indoctrinated. So it's a moment, I think, that people, this affected many families, and it has sort of, people tried to forget and not talk about it. So, yeah.
I want to thank you also for a fascinating talk. I was wondering in your research if you've come across the True Light Middle School.
Yes.
Okay. That's my mother from Honolulu in, I think, 29 when she was 18, went to the school in Canton, and I understand there's one in Hong Kong as well, or was, yeah.
And yeah.
If you could tell me a little bit more about, you know, what role that school played in this immigration?
Yeah, I mean, what I discovered over time was that, so beginning, especially in the 1910s, it was pretty common for, even after the turn of the century, as I mentioned, it was very common for people to send their kids, China-born people living in the U.S., to send their kids to Hong Kong and South China to attend village schools generally. The kids had problems, right? You don't know much more than nursery Chinese, maybe not the standard Cantonese dialect, but maybe not the, you know, the dialect used in the school. And this, actually, I found this kind of constant stream of complaints from the schools, from the various education bureaucrats about overseas Chinese in the schools not being able to keep up and really falling behind. So by the 1910s and 20s, you start to see the establishment of special overseas branches of schools, many of them connected to, and I can't remember offhand if True Light predated this, but a lot of these schools really start to bloom in the teens and 20s, first because they depend increasingly on donations from overseas Chinese Christians, but also overseas Chinese from around the world are sending their kids to these places because they can study in English and Chinese. They can learn Chinese, but they can also study in English. And one of the interesting things I found about this, there was almost kind of an overseas Chinese world that existed kind of parallel with the Chinese world in South China. And it was an institutional world. It had schools like True Light, Poi Toi Academy, and these other local academies often were branch feeder schools of this larger university. It became the first university along Western lines in South China, called the Canton Christian College, later known as Lingnan University, which in a lot of ways is the flagship school of the overseas Chinese world. And you look at where people are attending, the people are coming from Tasmania, Singapore, San Francisco, Denver, Yokohama. I mean, and they're coming to South China to study in Cantonese. Cantonese is the language you need if you're going to have a social life at the school. But they have an identity that's distinct from being just ordinary Chinese, right? And that identity becomes, as I mentioned in the talk, really problematic when the nationalists begin to adopt an anti-imperialist ideology, because a lot of the people sending their kids to these schools are living in colonies of Britain or France and making their living that way. And a lot of overseas Chinese begin to send their kids explicitly, exclusively to these schools because they're safe from marauding bandits who are attacking overseas Chinese villages or places that are seen as centers of wealth. But by the mid to late 1920s, a lot of people remove their kids from the schools for a few years until things settle down, and then they become popular again in the late 20s and 30s. And they were targets even of the Japanese in 1937-38 during the invasion of Guangdong. So that's why a lot of them, they established Hong Kong campuses in the 20s to avoid the nationalist movement, but those Hong Kong campuses become increasingly popular during the Japanese occupation, and then they're, of course, swamped when the Japanese take over. So this is really, it's a little bit too much to get into, but it's I think, kind of a fascinating story of this world that's a parallel world to actual China. This is overseas Chinese world where people have really distinct identities.
Well, it's an interesting thing because my father had that village experience where his father took the family back from Honolulu, you know, to the village. And I mean, I remember one of the things he said was they were called the brown monkeys because they came from Hawaii and, you know, they didn't speak Chinese or they didn't know, you know, they were Hakka, so they came from a Hakka village and they didn't know the language too well.
Well, I think it was common. And one of the things is a lot of Hawaiians ended up at Lingnan, and they ended up at St. John's University, your father, did I know? And they became the backbone of the sports teams, the football players. I mean, St. John's had the best football team in China. They were the South China Baseball League. The girls' baseball teams and the women's baseball teams, they were all Hawaiian because athletics had been really embraced in Hawaii, but not yet in China. And so, in fact, a lot of the athletes who represented China at the Far Eastern Games in the 20s and 30s were Hawaiians and U.S. mainlanders.
There's so many responses to our questions that I want to just draw a few connections to, because you mentioned about how in the United States that history of second generation Chinese Americans going back to China and coming back has really been, I think, glossed over. Kind of picking up on also what you're saying about just, I think, this other identity and the secondary culture that was existed among the overseas Chinese. Did you also, and also what you're saying about how it's hard to do research in China, did you also find that in China, that part of Chinese history where Chinese Americans made an impact in sports, I think a lot in architecture as well, that influence was also kind of covered up or glossed over?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those subjects where it's one of those subjects where it doesn't really bolster anybody's nationalist narrative of greatness. And so, because the United States isn't supposed to be an immigrant-sending nation, these folks get lost, as do a number of other groups. Like, there are a lot of Japanese Americans who went to Japan or Manchukuo, the puppet state, because they didn't have opportunities in pre-war America. But the problem in China is a lot of times the way that so-called overseas Chinese are treated. The overseas Chinese are referred to as, you know, sort of returning to the motherland. And their worth is in the fact that they chose to return to the motherland. And the fact is, a lot of these people that I write about, they didn't really have a comfortable home in the motherland. They didn't. It was quite different than what they expected. So they do choose to live in these Chinese contexts, but outside the reach of the government. And after 1949, most of them do not choose to stay in the PRC. Obviously, they don't go to Taiwan either. If they stay in Asia, they're in Hong Kong, which I think of as sort of the long afterlife of this thing called the overseas Chinese world, right, where you can be Chinese, but outside of the reach of these competing governments. And for that reason, you know, history often, we see it used to bolster a nationalist narrative of greatness. These people don't do that comfortably, so I think that's why they do fall out of accounts on both sides of the Pacific, unfortunately.
I was just wondering, during the years of the Depression, I think a lot of merchants and a lot of, Chinese immigrants that had families here just sent their families back to China just because it wasn't economically viable for them here. So it wasn't necessarily a career choice. It was more of an economic choice. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about that out-migration or the return migration, what percentage do you know was career-oriented choice versus an economic choice?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, I've found that for the Depression era, that whole families were sent. I mean, people sent their kids to study. They wanted them to get a Chinese education in the village to know their parents, or grandparents in this case, but it was also much cheaper. It's really impossible to know the percentages. Like I said, so what's actually kind of interesting is that people continued to send their children and come themselves to South China all the way till 1941. And this Japanese troops occupied Guangdong, most of Guangdong, in 1938. So people are, I think that's kind of a comment on the way that people identified as Chinese, but not necessarily with a nationalist, a sort of an abstract identity. It's really difficult to know, and one of the tricks with this book was trying to read the statistics carefully because, of course, when I talk about people who are purporting to be U.S. citizens, paper sons were listed in censuses and immigration statistics as native-born. They weren't differentiated. But there are enough statistics in certain ways that you can kind of read them. I think in the 20s, people, by and large, they actually had to note if they were departing permanently. I don't know who in 1917 created the immigration law and put that in there. I know who created the immigration law. I don't know who put that in there, but bless them, because it gives us statistics on people, their ancestry, where they're coming from, and where they're going, and if they consider this permanent relocation. Those statistics dry up in 1932. That said, I actually do think that I like to use the same definitions that we apply to European immigrants. And a lot of European immigrants before the quotas were used in 1924 came often for a season, or they came as to earn money, and then they went and they came and they went, right? And we as historians always call these people immigrants. But the Chinese Americans, they're somehow perpetually foreign, so they're not really immigrants. That's one of the things I grapple with the introduction is, you know, if we talk about motivations, people's plans change, their identities change. A lot of the Chinese American kids who went in the Depression, they ended up getting married and having kids and end up in Hong Kong because they can't get back or they can't leave, right? We don't know. So it's a sort of unfortunate, but I think you can't say that for any group. In fact, this group has more immigration statistics on it than any, which was, although you have to read between the lines, was actually very, very useful. The silver lining for a terrible policy. Yeah.
Professor, So I just want to say thank you for giving the talk. I'm definitely going to buy the book.
Oh.
But I just wish I had it with me so I could give me an autograph. But I guess my question is, and you touched on these points a little bit earlier, but overall, how would you evaluate, I guess, the wider legacy of this Chinese-American emigration to China and then re-migration back to America? Would you say it was just like a blip in the historical record, or would you say it was like, did it have any lasting impact, I guess?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it did have some impact. It's kind of been hidden on the development of the Republic of China. In the period after 1901, among other things, you know, you had Chinese Americans develop a modern air force, for better or for worse, develop aerial bombing. Some of the first wars using aerial bombing, that was Tom Gunn and Art Lim and their comrades. You had them develop the beginnings of a modern legal system. So somebody I follow in the book who ended up collaborating with the Japanese after really being bypassed by the nationalists for better positions, he was one of the first justices of the fledgling Qing Supreme Court. This is a guy who had been a lawyer in Honolulu a few years earlier, and they had a meteoric rise. So trying to develop Qing law, but then trying to, you know, some of the first surveys of the Yellow River were done by Chinese-American engineers. A lot of Chinese-Americans studied engineering. They saw that as how to modernize China. So, you know, so a lot of the first surveys of China's resources, some of the first road building. And these are, you know, these are kind of scattered points, I know. And I think perhaps if, I mean, you know, one of those ifs that is kind of useless to talk about, but if the war hadn't come, I think if the Japanese hadn't invaded, if the communists hadn't been victorious, there'd probably be more of an impact. But I also know that the nationalists really shut Chinese Americans out of positions of influence. So a lot of the influence was in the early years. And I also think, actually, one of the less understood influences is the relationship between China and the United States and their ongoing wrangle over the citizenship of these people. By the mid-1920s, the United States government had washed its hands of Chinese Americans in China, and the local U.S. consulate, the consular officials saw, in a sense, sacrificing protection of Chinese Americans as a way to protect the extraterritoriality of white Americans for as long as possible while making nice with the new nationalist regime. So there are moments like that, you know, did create this legacy, but a pretty spotty and mixed one.
Have you seen a trend where, as we're approaching modern day and as technology connects more people across the world, is there a trend where these specific people have more of a sort of
advantage
where they can connect the two worlds in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason people eventually had to pick a side was that war forces you to do that even if you don't want to. For, I think, 40 years, a lot of these people didn't want to pick a side. They wanted to be Chinese. They weren't allowed to be American because of the racial nationalism that was ascendant in the United States before the war. They wanted to be Chinese, but a succession of regimes, especially the nationalists, cast doubt on their legitimate Chineseness because of their habits and their language and the same things the U.S. government did, their habits, their language, their everything. They don't want to pick a side. They end up living and balancing. I'm not sure about now, honestly. I mean, this is where I fail, perhaps, as a prognosticator or a commentator. I'm more of a historian. But I think there's more respect now for the idea that I at least like to continue to believe that there's more respect now despite evidence to the contrary in our current day in politics, but that there is room for a richer identity, and certainly there is room for richer identities in America than there was before the war, you know, as much as that's contested in a city like ours, and a lot of the places where Chinese Americans came from, Honolulu, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, there is.